Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and I'm glad to have you listening. In this hour of the show, we'll be taking up a subject that certainly has been much debated, particularly during the last, 10 years or so. And that is, how does one account for the vast differences, both economic and political, between the countries of Europe and the United States and the Middle East? During the Middle Ages, the economy of the Middle East was at least as well developed as that of Europe. But within a relatively short period of time, a couple of centuries, the Middle East had fallen dramatically behind. So the question is, why is it that this region failed to modernize economically as the West surged ahead? That is a question that our guest for this hour takes up in his book, The Long Divergence, How Islamic Law Held Back the Middle East. Our guest is Timur Kuran. He's professor of economics and political science at Duke University, where he is also the Gorder Family Professor of Islamic Studies. He's visiting the campus to give a talk. His visit here is sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy, and this is the Klein Symposium for 2012, After the Arab Spring, the Future of Democracy in the Middle East. He'll be giving a talk on the campus tonight at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center Ballroom. He'll be speaking on the subject, Religious Obstacles to Democratization in the Middle East, Past and Present. This is the keynote address. So I think that anybody who was interested in hearing what he had to say should feel welcome to stop by. And if you're interested in the book, it is published by the Princeton University Press. Got quite a lot of attention when it came out. And so we'll talk about a little bit about the arguments that he makes in the book, in The Long Divergence, and then perhaps go from economics to talking about politics. And questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be here, David.
Before going on to the main arguments that you make in The Long Divergence, let me ask about a couple of other things, and certainly that you do touch on them. And that has to do with some of the things that people have said about Islam and economics to try to explain this big difference that we have seen between countries of the Middle East and Europe. And that people, one of the things that arguments that people have made is they had said, well, Islam is really somehow fundamentally anti-business. And I think that you would say, no, not true.
I would say no. The evidence is that Islam is quite compatible with business. For one thing, the founder of the religion was a merchant who was quite familiar with the needs of merchants and what it takes to promote economic growth and promote commerce. The Quran, the holy book of Islam, contains many verses that are music to the ears of merchants. It says, even in some places, that you can combine piety with commerce, even when you're going on your a pilgrimage to Mecca, which you're supposed to do once in a lifetime. You should be free to combine commercial pursuits and make money during the pilgrimage. The largest fair of the world for many, many centuries, largest commercial fair, was established in Mecca. To that, I could add that the jurists who put into place what we call the Sharia now, classical Islamic law, were involved in commerce as merchants or investors. The rules they adopted were quite friendly to commerce. And finally, the Middle East was a crossroads for commerce, and Middle Easterners, including Muslim Middle Easterners, were quite successful in commerce until relatively recent centuries. Mm-hmm. They dominated the Indian Ocean trade. They dominated the caravan trade, went from the Middle East and southern Russia all the way to China, and one branch of it, of course, went to India. if Islam was hostile to commerce, inherently hostile to commerce, they couldn't have been that successful.
Just for a moment, let me ask about one other, have you talked about one other thing? And that is that what is commonly said is that, well, what has held back these countries is Western imperialism, essentially, that they have been held down and held back by the forces of imperialism and colonialism.
Let me start by saying that the so-called forces of colonialism and imperialism have not been angels. The Western powers that pursued economic interests in the Middle East, and Latin America, and other parts of the world were not interested solely or even mostly in developing these countries. They were interested in advancing their own interests and in profiting. That said, and focusing on the Middle East, I should say that the modern imperialism followed the slip into economic underdevelopment of the region rather than precede it. Westerners, the French, the Italians, the British, the Dutch, others, had long wanted to colonize the Middle East. After all, the Crusades were launched to redominate the Middle East, to push out the Muslims. They did not succeed, and there's a very good reason why they didn't succeed. The Middle East was doing very well economically, and the Crusaders had a hard time winning the allegiance even of the local Christians, who were very, very numerous. When they came back, starting in the 18th century and quite successfully in the 19th century, they were successful because they were economically dominant. They had politically strong states. They were militarily dominant, which is related to their successes in politics and economics. So that is what explains why they were so successful. And I would add, they brought to the region many useful institutions which made local minorities, the local Christians and Jews, want to partner with them in business, want to become their political protégés, and got Muslims interested in changing their own laws. They started recognizing the superiority in certain respects of the laws of the Westerners over the traditional laws of the Middle East, which were based on the Quran and Islam in general.
So if we set those two things apart, then we come to the argument that you make in Long Divergence, which I think is really interesting, and it leads one to focus on what some people might say is a sort of a small detail of Islamic law, but in the argument you make really looms very, very large. And maybe the way to start talking about it is to just make the observation that if you do go back to the Middle Ages and you look at Europe and you look at the Middle East and you look at how people came together to do business, there wasn't that much difference. That it was really mostly about families, people who were close, small groups of people who knew each other very well, who were going into business together.
Yes, in the Middle Ages, you didn't find substantial differences between the way you did business in, say, France and the way you did business in Turkey or Syria. It was personal business, or it was based on personal exchange, in that you typically knew the person you were doing business with, you were entering into a contract with. So that is one commonality. You did not have impersonal exchange anywhere. Another commonality is that the type of contracting that occurred was of a small scale and for short durations. So if you and I wanted to engage in commerce between Illinois and the American West Coast, we would typically do it together. We might have a third or fourth partner. We would not have 50 other partners. And we typically agree to finance a mission to carry corn from Illinois to California, and then presumably we'd be successful, and with the proceeds we'd buy grapes or wine or something, and we'd bring that back, sell it in Illinois, and if we have a profit, divide the profits, and that would be the end of the mission. Be nothing to prevent us from recontracting. If we were very successful, we might do the same thing again with the two of us, maybe some couple of other additional partners. But the point is, this is a very simple arrangement, very simple contract, short-lived contract. And this would have been the same in France and Turkey and Syria, and going further east, you would find the same thing. Mm-hmm. You did not find large numbers of people pooling resource and capital for long periods of time, and certainly not indefinitely, the way a modern corporation does.
Which is the thing that you did start to see in Europe, that does indeed get us to the modern corporation, where you have large numbers of people coming together. They don't know each other. They're just in it for the investment. They pool their resources. There may be shares sold, and it may result in an entity, in a corporate entity, that could well, and perhaps should well, outlive the founders.
Yes.
That doesn't happen in the Middle East.
Yes.
And your argument basically is that, well, there are a couple of things that are aspects of Islamic law that have to do with how partnerships are organized, and particularly inheritance. What happens when somebody dies, how their assets are divided up, that you said really works against this kind of, essentially it works against moving towards the modern corporation.
Yes. So in the year 1000 or 1100, there's no difference between the Middle East and Western Europe. As we move forward in time, by the time we get to 1500, we see that there's no difference in the Middle East, but in Western Europe, we see larger numbers of people pooling resources for longer time periods. Something had to be different. We know the partnership law is the same, but something else must have been affecting the incentives to add more people to the organization. And the difference is the inheritance system. Islam has a highly egalitarian inheritance system for the Middle Ages, in that all children receive mandatory shares. If parents are alive, they receive mandatory shares. If a spouse or spouses are alive, they receive shares. And in some, under some conditions, even more distant relatives, uncles, aunts, nieces, nephews receive shares. Now, this means that if we form a partnership and a member of the partnership dies prematurely — this was not a rare happening in the Middle Ages. There were epidemics. There were all sorts of reasons why people died, because of poor medical care. The mission, according to the law — and this is the same in Europe as in the Middle East — the mission at that point is null and void. The assets have to be divided. The enterprise has to be liquidated. And the shares of the share of the deceased partner has to be distributed to all the heirs. In principle, the enterprise could immediately resume because all the heirs could decide that if it's a profitable mission carrying goods between Illinois and California, that they want to continue. They'll just put the resources back in. In practice, this rarely happened. There was always a child who wanted cash instead. There were other people who didn't want to participate in commerce. So the thing fell apart. And anticipating this, anticipating the problems and the losses that were involved, people kept the partnership small. Because the fewer people you have in a partnership, the lower the risks of premature dissolution. And they also kept the duration small. We would agree to a mission, a trading mission that would carry goods from Illinois to California and back, not an unlimited thing, an agreement that would just involve trade wherever opportunities arise over the next 5 years. What was different in Europe? In Europe, because the Bible does not specify an inheritance system the way the Quran does, the Islamic inheritance system is based on the Quran, you had a bewildering array of inheritance systems. They were all based doctrinally in the Bible, but they were very, very different. Some of them were as egalitarian as the Islamic inheritance system, but you had ones that went to the other extreme, primogeniture, under which the entire wealth went to the oldest son. This was quite popular in northern France, in the Low Countries, Belgium and Denmark and Holland, in Scandinavia, in England, in parts of northern Germany. I'd like to point out that these are the areas where the Industrial Revolution takes off many centuries later. Now, primogeniture is a highly inegalitarian inheritance system that seems very unjust to us. The oldest son gets everything. Other sons get nothing. They typically are sent to the ministry, the military. Daughters get nothing. They're typically married off, unlike their counterparts in the Middle East, who at least receive some shares, they own some assets. Mm-hmm. So primogeniture is unjust, but it has one advantage. It promotes the continuity of business.
Yeah.
And it encourages, it puts in place a substitute for every partner, reducing the disincentive to forming large partnerships. So now we no longer will be as reluctant to bring in many more people into our partnership because each person comes with a substitute. And that substitute will be trained, knowing that sooner or later the father is going to die or become incapacitated or become too old to work. The son will be trained in the business. He will become an apprentice there. So he's ready to step in, which reduces the risk to us to forming a large organization. And once we start having larger and larger commercial organizations, we start facing communication and coordination problems that make us think of more advanced organizational forms. And we start moving from the simple partnership to joint stock companies and eventually to the corporation.
Mm-hmm. Which means that you have stock markets. You may also have to have the development of fairly sophisticated banking industries because you need capital for your business. And all these institutions grow. And in the Middle East, there was simply no need.
There's simply no need. So
them.
It's not that Islam is inherently incompatible with banking. After all, we have banks today. We even have Islamic banks. Mm-hmm. It's not that the corporation is inherently incompatible with Islam. We have corporations today in the Middle East. The need just doesn't arise, and the need doesn't emerge for stock markets. But you do get stock markets in Europe. They grow from below because when you start having hundreds of partners, inevitably someone has a crisis, a family crisis, and needs cash. They want to be able to sell it quickly and convert their share into cash. And so the stock market is where they do it. They start trading initially in Lloyd's Cafe and in places like that. And before long, those places generate stock markets. And this, of course, then in turn, the availability of stock markets makes it more attractive to invest in businesses in the first place. It becomes easier for, we started out with our two-person company, now we have 100, it's going to be easier for us to raise capital because by now we have a track record. People who buy who invest in our company will be able to pull out the next day if they want to, or 5 years later if they want to, they'll be able to do it at will. And there is a liquid market where they can do this.
Let me just introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus. You're listening to Timur Kuran. He is professor of economics and political science at Duke University, and he has essentially just laid out the argument that he makes in much more detail in his book, The Long Divergence, How Islamic Law Held Back the Middle East. That is the subtitle. The book is published by the Princeton University Press in 2010. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be talking perhaps a bit on this, but also further talking about politics in the Middle East. He's here to give the keynote address for the 2012 Klein Symposium, After the Arab Spring, the Future of Democracy in the Middle East. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I think it is the case that once we get into the 19th and certainly into the 20th century, there are countries in the Middle East and the region that do bring in the institutions that we're talking about, corporations and banks and stock markets. And certainly, I think in the 19th century in Turkey, there was a very deliberate effort to introduce Western-style economic entities. So it seemed that at least at that point that the laws that we're talking about didn't prevent that from happening. I mean, how was that possible, or were there obstacles that they had to overcome?
Well, an obstacle that they had to overcome was the resistance of clerics. And this is why ultimately this reform that you mentioned, the formation of the first modern company was a reform from above, by the Sultan, who was also the caliph of at least Sunni Islam. He was the head religious figure. It was very difficult for Muslims individually to change the law, because Islam, like Judaism, is a law-based religion. To be a good Muslim is to live like a Muslim. And to live like a Muslim meant that to do business, you did so under Islamic institutions. The Islamic institutions in the first half of the 19th century were those of the Middle Ages. Muslim merchants realized that they couldn't compete with the Europeans, who were by then flooding the region, settling in the region in large numbers, and they could not compete with the minorities, the local Christian and Jewish minorities, who had under, this is another theme now that I'm bringing in, who under Islamic law enjoyed what is called choice of law. They were free to do business under Islamic institutions, but they could, if they wanted to, use their own indigenous institutions or some other institutions. In the Middle Ages, Islamic institutions were not inferior to their own institutions, so they tended to do business under Islamic institutions. In the 19th century, they noticed that the institutions of the Europeans were far superior. And as individuals under the law of the land in the Middle East, Jews and Christians were able to start doing business under Western laws, forming joint stock companies, investing in corporations. Muslims could not do this as individuals. And that is why the Sultan felt a need to change things by setting up a modern organization as a prototype from above. Mm-hmm. And of course, in doing so, he got the got fatwas, religious support from the clerics. And this is what started. This was the first move toward economic modernization in the Middle East.
We have a couple of callers here, and we will continue, of course, to talk with our guest, Timur Kuran, in just a moment. First, let's take a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, it is our program we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do it every other month with Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carl in Urbana. Whatever questions you have are welcome. Tomorrow morning at 10, Sandy Mason will be here. She is with Extension at the University of Illinois. And every month she is here and we talk about things that grow in the home landscape, lawn and garden care. Then also tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we will be pleased to have on this program once again as our guest Martin Marty, perhaps this country's best known writer about Christianity, certainly among the best known. He is Professor Emeritus of the History of Modern Christianity at the Divinity School at University of Chicago, and he will be on the campus to give a talk. And we'll talk with him tomorrow morning in our 11 o'clock hour. We are here weekday mornings, again, from 10 until noon. You can check the schedule by going to our website, WILL.illinois.edu, and that way you can also listen to past programs. In this hour of the program, our guest is Professor Timur Kuran. He's Professor of Economics and Political Science at Duke University, where he is also the Gorder Family Professor of Islamic Studies. He is the Gorder Family Professor of Islamic Studies at Duke, and he is visiting here on the campus. He'll be giving the keynote speech for this year's Klein Symposium, After the Arab Spring, the Future of Democracy in the Middle East. This is sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy on the U of I campus. And again, if you'd like to read the book that we have been talking about, the book is entitled The Long Divergence, How Islamic Law Held Back the Middle East. It came out last year, published by the Princeton University Press. So questions welcome. We have a couple of folks here ready to go. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. We'll start with a caller in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I think there's a couple ways that colonialism is getting short shrift in the contra against the development of the Middle East. And one thing has to do with kind of a rosy scenario for how corporations developed in the West. A lot of the corporations were initially crown chartered. East India Company, notably, has a very curious flag. It's a very statist origin, so it isn't. I'm not taking away from your argument about primogeniture that much, but I think that needs to be counted. And also, the role of the Western states in sort of preferring the sort of monarchical structure in the Middle East, bulwarking and reinforcing some of the most reactionary regimes. I mean, there's clearly the contemporary argument for that, Devil's Game by Robert Dreyfus, notably. But I think it goes back historically, and I think it's something that one would have to account for, and I'm wondering how you do, if that point is clear.
You've made two interesting points, and let me start with the first, the one about corporations. You're absolutely right that Western states, starting with the English crown and the Dutch crown, they both played a role in the development of the first business corporations which were engaged in global trade. The reason why the corporation was particularly useful in global trade is that people had to, when ships left Northern Europe for Indonesia or India, they were usually gone for a long time, and it was useful to have an organization that that had a longer life than the typical partnership. These organizations also operated on a scale that required investments from many people. You're absolutely right. The state played a role in promoting them. But once that had happened, many corporations that did not have the same ties to the state got organized. And the largest private companies in the 19th century, which played an important role in advancing the Industrial Revolution, were corporations. With regard to corporations, I'd like to point out that even though the East India Company and the Dutch East Indies companies were the first business corporations, they were not the first corporations. The corporation had existed in Western Europe for more than 1,000 years. Thousands of cities were already chartered as corporations. Religious orders and monasteries and guilds were organized as corporations. The Roman Church eventually declared itself a corporation in the 1100s. So by the time the need arose for having business corporations in Europe, the legal systems of the continent had a great deal of experience with corporations and corporations in general, and people were quite accustomed to dealing with fictitious personalities as opposed to real people, natural people in court. This made this smoothed the transition to the business corporation. Now, coming to your second point about Western states preferring monarchical structures, I assume you mean preferring these in the Middle East and promoting in recent times. Is that what you implied?
Yeah, but extending back in more, maybe more subtle ways, not as demonstrated. But, I mean, the Saudi kingdom is sort of the archetypal example of the satrapy that functions so well for Aramco.
Yeah, this goes back to a point I made early on, that the Western regimes that have done business in the Middle East have certainly been pursuing their personal interests, and where they've found it in their interest to make deals with existing monarchies, whatever their values, whatever their internal policies, they have certainly done so. The question, though, would be whether, or a critical question for me, is whether these Western states have de-democratized the region. In other words, done things that weakened existing democracies and put monarchies in their place, or whether they've simply accepted existing structures and not tried in certain cases, or perhaps in many cases, to move them in the direction of democracy. And I think the latter is the case, which raises the question of why the region did not democratize from below. Democracies did emerge in Western Europe. It was a long, long process. Monarchies resisted for many centuries. Democracy became the norm in Western Europe relatively recently. That is a process that has not taken place in the Middle East, and it has to do with the evolution that I was talking about earlier. I will just give you one mechanism that reduced the likelihood of democratization in the Middle East, and that has to do with the atomistic scale of business. Democracy is a system of checks and balances. The checks and balances come partly from the business community. If the business community consists of very small-scale, ephemeral organizations, they're not well-suited to provide those checks and balances. But if instead the commercial sector, the investment sector, contains some very large players who have a stake, who have a measurable stake in the health of the economy, they're going to, as was the case in Europe by the 18th and 19th century, they're going to start putting pressure on the central government. They're going to try to constrain it in some respects. They're going to play an adversarial role where they feel that this is in their interest, and this is all part of the democratic system.
I thank the caller for the questions. We're getting into about our last 12 or 13 minutes. I have some other callers and want to give them a chance as well, and we'll go next to Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I've got a question about educational systems and the importance of an education that maybe in some Muslim countries, there's an emphasis on religious education as opposed to as much emphasis on just a general education. Could you talk about that at all and whether that has impacted development?
Yes, absolutely. And again, I'd want to provide a historical perspective. If you go back to the Middle East, as far as historians can tell, we don't have differences in literacy rates between Western Europe and the Middle East, and the quality of education is no better and no worse. Religion plays an important role in education, but students also learn some mathematics, they learn some geography, and so on. The same is true at the highest level of education. If you compare the early universities in Europe, Oxford and Cambridge, for example, and the leading madrasas, the colleges of the Middle East, the quality of education, looking at their curricula, is quite similar. Now, over time, the quality of education improves in the West and it stagnates in the East. This has to do with the institutions that these different school systems are using. In the West, schools are organized as corporations, which means they're self-governing, which means that as the knowledge base changes, they can change, the schools can change their curriculum. So as the global explorations take place and we learn that the world isn't flat, it has a different shape, we learn about new continents, old geography texts that are based on the that were based then on the fundamentally on the ancient Greeks, those get discarded and we get new geography texts. In the Middle East, the madrasas were not colleges, were not corporations. They were established as trusts. And in practice, what this meant is that the founder decided what the curriculum was going to be and typically also what textbooks were going to be used. And if he had said that a particular Greek luminary's geography book was going to be used, that typically had to be used forevermore to teach geography to the students. I'm giving you an extreme example, and there were sometimes ways around this, but usually didn't work. And in practice, as late as the 17th century, well after the global explorations, there were students in the Middle East that were learning geography through texts based on the ancient Greeks. So the quality of education fell dramatically, and therefore the usefulness, and therefore the incentives to get education. So this is one mechanism. It's not the only mechanism, but in the interest of time, I think there are other callers. I will leave it at that, and you can find some more details in The Long Divergence.
All right. Well, again, I think the caller will go on to line number 3. This is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I actually read your book and tried to study it a bit, so I'm really glad you were able to come here. One of the things that I'm sort of trying to get my head to sort of figure out is I feel like your arguments are very, of course, it's all about the corporation. It just seems like, isn't it, there are different dominating systems and special interests, and so there is a period where there's this sort of growing ascendancy of, I guess you would say, sort of like a Western capitalist system that, in fact, as the first caller said, I mean, the gradual debt of places like Ottoman Egypt and the Ottoman world has a lot to do with also their, it seems to me, their increasing decline. So those like minorities you were talking about when they had choice of what kind of law, I mean, obviously there were a lot of them, weren't there, that were attached, that were proteges. So, for example, Jewish and Christian minorities in the Ottoman Empire could, in fact, have the protection of England or France or whatever. I mean, like they could.
Yes,
sort of
that's
have
right.
Both
they
ways,
they bought,
you know?
They bought the protection of those.
Like both, yeah. They could have it both ways.
Yes.
I mean, they could even commit crimes and not be tried. Anyway, okay. So the thing is, it just seems to me that in history, that there's a lot of things going on, and I'm just saying that when I read your book, I saw like a predominantly, like this one thesis, but it just seems sort of deterministic, or I don't know if you call it structural, that there's so many other things going on. Why? And I guess what I would take issue with is sort of like this word Islamic, because I don't know, Islamic to me seems like it means the superlative of Islam rather than Muslim, because I mean the Muslim world it's always been really diverse, right? I mean, not everybody looked to the Sultan. I mean, there's North Africa, there's Central Asia, there was, you know. So I'm just feeling like it's there are other things that are sort of, I don't know, maybe it's because it's such a big thesis that you want to concentrate on this one thing, but it seems like there are other like context and contingency that I didn't pick up in the book. I don't know if maybe you'll talk about it, how it relates to the Arab Spring or not, but I'm just sort of wondering, because it's like primarily, it's sort of like you took something and you stripped it away, but there's all these other things that affect like what happens to a country or a people or a period in time that really don't. Maybe they say Islamic or it's due to Islam, but in fact it's due to a particular way of interpreting it or what's going on with the law. I don't know.
Yeah, when you've raised some excellent questions, and we only have about 5 minutes left, so I wanted to give Professor Curran a chance to respond to some of that.
Yes, you've made some excellent points. Yes, in fact, there are many, many, many things going on, and the challenge I faced as a scholar was to identify the most important and most important in terms of their consequences for economic development, and also ones that were common to a broad area. Now, you will have noticed in reading the book, and it's also reflected in the title, I apply the argument to the Middle East. This does not include India. It does not include Indonesia, that are also places that contain large numbers of Muslims. There was a good reason for that. There are other factors that played important roles in those places. I'm currently working on a side project on India. Some of the themes in the Long Divergence were important there. Some of them were not, and there were other mechanisms at play that were at play that led Muslims to fall behind Hindus, the way Muslims fell behind Christians and Jews in the Middle East. So context certainly matters. You're absolutely right. And in other regions, other mechanisms play an important role. Now, here, I do make clear that I'm talking about the role of Islamic law in holding back the region rather than Islam per se. I'm not dealing with beliefs, and I don't think beliefs were critical. Beliefs are quite malleable. But I think that there are certain elements of Islamic law that were common to the region during this entire period that I cover, about a 1,000-year period, the Waqf, the Islamic Trust that we haven't talked much about here. The inheritance system, the marriage system, these were all quite critical, and I've identified those. And of course, there's a lot more to Islamic law. There are many other elements of Islamic law that did not play an important role one way or another, and proved actually to be quite flexible. And part of the puzzle that I deal with in the Long Divergence is why there was a great deal of flexibility in other areas, but not in these particular areas. And that's part of the argument of the book. One of the challenges is to establish why there was no flexibility in these areas, but there was in other areas.
We're coming to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. And certainly, I would suggest if people would like to explore these ideas further, they can go out and read The Long Divergence. Also, folks can hear our guest talk tonight. And maybe for the benefit of those people who cannot attend the talk, I'm interested in seeing if you can extend this a little bit further and talk about politics. And certainly here over the last year and a half or so, at least over the last year and a half or so, people have been watching closely what's been happening in the Middle East and asking questions about the possibility for progress in a democratic sense, and wondering what might be likely to happen, and could there be change, and how long it would take for that change to occur.
So as you pointed out, this is a theme that I'm going to develop this evening, and I'm working on in a separate book. The puzzle here is that just as this region did not develop as rapidly as the West and fell behind, it also did not democratize. Autocracy remains the norm in the region. What could have caused it, and are the economic institutions that led to underdeveloped and that are studied in the Long Divergence, did they play a role? The answer is yes, the two processes were connected. I'll give you one example. The Islamic Trust played a role in holding the region back economically. It sucked capital out of the commercial sector. They were very rigid organizations that could not adapt to technological change and therefore were becoming prone to dysfunction, becoming dysfunctional. These organizations, which controlled a huge amount of resources, these Islamic trusts, also were completely apolitical organizations. They were non-governmental organizations, but they could not use their resources to fulfill an adversarial function in society, adversarial to the Sultan. They could not monitor the Sultan. They could not criticize the Sultan. They could not play the role of an opposition. So this is one of the reasons why democratization movements just didn't get going in the region. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's a theme I can elaborate if we have more time.
I'm sorry to say that we really don't. At this point, we're going to have to stop because we're here coming to the end of the time. And I would like again to say that our guest, Timur Kuran, he's professor of economics and political science at Duke, is visiting the campus to give the keynote address for this year's Klein Symposium, After the Arab Spring, the Future of Democracy in the Middle East. This is sponsored by the Klein Center for Democracy, based at the University of Illinois. And he'll be giving this talk, Religious Obstacles to Democratization in the Middle East, Past and Present, tonight at 7:30 at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center Ballroom on the U of I campus. Also, again, if you're interested in reading his book, The Long Divergence, it is published by the Princeton University Press. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.